Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is the last day of July, the 31st, 2020. I am John Podhortz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism. From a conservative perspective, we invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We'll give you a few free reads, and we ask you to subscribe. Christine Rosen is out this week. With me, as always, executive editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And joining us today, tech commentary columnist James B. Meggs. Jim, thanks for joining us second time on the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Great. So we will turn to Jim's very original writings on these matters of tech in a moment. But first, I think it is incumbent upon us, given the trashing and we delivered yesterday to the president and his insane postpone the election tweet, to shift gears and then talk about his predecessor, Barack Obama's eulogy for John Lewis at the Ebenezer Baptist Church. Once again, a wonderful liberal event where nobody was mysteriously put in the position of having to socially distance. Because, of course, it being a funeral, a tribute, everyone could be within 6 feet of one another, while in many states, people are still not allowed to have funerals for people who aren't John Lewis. But we can put that to one side. The central message that Obama delivered in this speech was about how to pay proper tribute to John Lewis, the future and the rising tide of racism in America, that the Senate should get rid of the filibuster pretty much in order to make it possible for the Senate on a strict majority vote to increase the size of the Senate by four, by bringing in Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia as states. So here's my proposition to you. Look at Donald Trump. We talk about Donald Trump and we say he breaks norms, he violates norms, he is destructive of the institutions of the United States at a time when we need them more than ever. And he is therefore, you know, a threat or a danger to the Republic. Donald Trump's advance of some of these extra constitutional ideas and things that he is up to would not have been possible, this is my proposition, if Barack Obama had not softened the ground first. Systematically, once he lost his supermajority in the Senate, and after his first 2 years in which he passed or, you know, shepherded through four pieces of legislation that cost $2.5 trillion, the largest single increase in the sort of federal spending in history until pretty relatively recently during the pandemic, the nation rears back in horror. The House is taken by the Republicans. He is compelled to negotiate an extension of the Bush tax cuts. And then at some point in the middle of 2011, he decides he's had enough. He declares, we can't wait for the recalcitrant Congress to do its work. And he starts basically writing executive orders, praising himself for doing this, by the way, and using it as a campaign issue, writing executive orders to circumvent the will of Congress and essentially write legislation in the executive branch and in the White House, culminating in the declaration of the path to citizenship for the Dreamers and DACA. Most of these things that he did, many of them were overturned by courts on 9-0 votes. I mean, you know, like unanimous liberals and conservatives both, because they were patently unconstitutional, but he did it time and time and time again. and created the conditions under which Trump, somebody who doesn't care about institutional niceties and doesn't know anything about Washington and thinks that, you know, things should be done by fiat, comes in. But this, none of this would have been possible without Obama. Abe, you have...
I agree entirely. And also, I think what wouldn't have been possible without Obama, similarly, is the kind of inconstancy that making those drastic, that zigzagging like that means that we see with Trump. Obama spoke out passionately against the filibuster for years. Before he now has decided to oppose it because things must happen that he wants to see happen regardless of the institutional breaks.
Noah?
Again, completely agree. Just to focus, it wasn't exactly a Paul Wellstoning, but it was as close as you can get. I mean, the president going up there and making this big, broad case for progressive institutional changes, not principled objectives, but institutional changes to achieve principled objectives, making the election day a federal holiday, and as you said, making Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico a state, and ending partisan gerrymanders, eliminating the filibuster. I mean, that sort of thing, if the partisan roles were reversed, it would be regarded as extremely uncouth, at the very least an abandonment of the kind of niceties and decencies you should observe at a funeral. But I do want to, dwell on this filibuster thing for a little bit. We were arguing about this before the podcast began, but it's clear to me, I think, that the president just transformed the notion of the legislative filibuster from being a tool of minority rights into a racist relic of the Jim Crow era and turned it into a much more mainstream position than it was previously. This is something that you had heard only on the progressive fringe for the most part. And it has to be said that the Democratic Party is the minority party in the U.S. Senate right now. They are the beneficiaries of these minority protections, and they are not shy about appealing to them. Senate Republicans have been forced to hold roll call votes over the course of the Trump administrations to break filibusters on nominees 314 times. According to Politico, which examined the Senate tally, all previous presidents combined faced a grand total of 244 roll call votes to advance a nominee over a filibuster. Democrats are using these protections. One of their arguments against the filibuster in 2013 was that Republicans appealed to it too often. And now you hear people, even moderates like Joe Biden, saying things like, well, the filibuster is probably going to have to go if Republicans are too obstreperous when they appeal to it. In other words, if Republicans oppose Democratic initiatives too vehemently, then they might have to abandon those minority protections. They're very generous of him. The notion here that Republicans are alone in assaulting the norms that have served as guardrails in American governance is betrayed by Barack Obama's record and his own speech.
Can we, Jim, do you have anything you want to
What I'm struck by here is, I'm thinking about how this idea will be received in the coming days and weeks. And I always go back to all of my liberal Westchester friends who have this image of Obama as being a very bland, moderate, sensible centrist who governed with a gentle kind of delicacy. And it's part of his genius as a politician, I think, that he often would find the words that sounded conciliatory and sort of conceal the iron fist that was under that velvet glove. And you saw it with the executive orders. You see it here. You saw it in sometimes his casual way of denigrating people, but without the coarse language that a Trump would use. And I think we're seeing it here. And what worries me is that perception tends to dominate the public memory of both his administration and his policies that he's advocating now.
So what strikes me as interesting is that if there is anything that makes the case for the rules that the filibuster takes advantage of, meaning the cloture rule that requires a three-fifths vote of the Senate to advance a piece of legislation to the floor to be voted on. If anything in the history of America makes this a good thing, it is the idea of expanding the size, the number of states in the union. Because the reason that we have this rule is to create a consensus view, a consensus position that is not simply partisan. Assuming, as has only rarely been the case, that the Senate, three-fifths of the Senate, is constituted of one party and not, you know, 54-46, 55-45, or whatever the number would have been before there were 50 states and 100 senators, this requires a consensus, because you have to get people from the other party to join in to vote to close debate in order to go to a vote on the Senate floor. That is, the filibuster is there to prevent the closing of debate, because the Senate rules effectively permit unlimited time for debate. House rules do not. House Rules Committee writes rules for every piece of legislation that sets the number of hours that something can be debated before there is a vote and before it then is brought to the floor. We're talking about adding senators. The last time senators were added was 60 years ago, right? It was 1960. And what happened then, in order to bring Alaska and Hawaii into the Senate, there was one Republican state and one Democratic state. Hawaii was Democratic, Alaska was Republican. It was understood that if a Democratic state was going to be brought in, a Republican state had to be brought in, and vice versa, in order to maintain proper comity in the political process. And so everybody got a taste, and everybody, and so the Senate was expanded. It is now 2020, and Democrats are going to push through on a partisan vote a change in the composition of the political makeup of the United States. I mean, fights over how many states and who was going to come into the union when were central to the decade before there was the Civil War. Slave state, free state, Henry Clay's Great Compromise. Like, this is a horrific idea that Obama is peddling. Horrific. Jim, I think the Metro North just went by.
I live right above the train tracks, as you guys
know. I love that. I love that. Remember that from last time. Anyway, so that's so basically, what Barack Obama is proposing here is something that will lead to, you know, if we are on the road to a kind of political dissolution in the United States, this is only going to advance it, because this is going to be the idea that Republicans will never be in charge of the Senate ever again, unless there is a huge political shift. The Democrats are enshrining a momentary tactical advantage. And if somebody comes up in 2024 and says, these guys, you know, we need to split off the Senate, we have to disempower the Senate, or, you know, break Texas up into five, or break California into three, or whatever, because we can't. And then basically we're talking about the collapse of the United States. I don't want to be too dramatic about this, but things are kind of hairy right now. And the idea that Barack Obama should come in and introduce this note into the political discussion right now, when his own vice president is running for president, promising a return to normalcy, and the return to normalcy is going to be maybe Democrats will win the Senate and then we can force through everything we want at will. That's insane and incredibly irresponsible, and points out, I think, that the person that we need to look to when we are talking about this onrush toward the destruction of our institutions at the executive branch level is not Donald Trump, but Barack Obama.
I mean, more than that, during his eulogy, I'm just going to highlight a couple of lines here that I think need to be said. Quote, Bull Connor may be gone today. We witness with our own eyes police officers kneeling on the necks of Black Americans. George Wallace may be gone, but we can witness our federal government sending agents to use tear gas and batons against peaceful demonstrators later. Quote, there are those in power that are doing their darndest to discourage people from voting, closing polling places, attacking our voting rights with surgical precision, even undermining the postal service in an election that's going to depend on mail-in ballots. Now, you can take a lot of issue with the factual accuracy of a lot of what he said. There's emphasis there that I think is completely inappropriate. Some of it's defensible, some of it's not. But what none of that is an effort to take the temperature down on a moment that where we're near boiling. And in that sense, it is completely irresponsible. And if it were any other person than Barack Obama, the commentary class would look upon this with contempt for its effort to agitate and aggravate a nation on the brink.
Here's what I think is particularly frightening about this. Obama made one public appearance in the wake of the George Floyd killing, in which he did, not sort of overtly, but implicitly, kind of attempt to sort of calm the discussion, to the extent that he talked up the idea that police are necessary and many of them are great, and that the U.S. has made extraordinary progress on racial matters. What changed? Well, what changed is that Obama's reputation for being sort of soft and reasoned and pragmatic is deserved to the extent that he likes to come across that way as a tactical matter to get across his more sort of actual genuinely radical ideology. What changed is that he sort of took the temperature of the room, so to speak, but of the nation, and determined that in this moment he no longer needs to cover up the more ambitious proposals and ideas in order to sell them. He can now, given the environment, come straight out and propose radical things like that.
And that's what makes it so egregious.
Right.
As Jim said, you know, he's perfectly capable of striking a conciliatory tone. He can get the tone absolutely right and has done on many occasions. That he chose not to do that, unlike Donald Trump. When Donald Trump strikes a conciliatory note and strikes the right tone, you are shocked because it is not in his nature to do that. Barack Obama is the consummate politician. He knows what he's doing when he's doing it. He chose to make an inflammatory speech in this particular moment, which makes it far more egregious.
Because he knows it'll sell now.
And no one is going to come out and right. criticize him, save the usual suspects, present company included.
I mean, look, the Obama administration sent the Bureau of Land Management, forces from the Bureau of Land Management, to surround and attempt to disarm and then take the lands of Clive and Bundy in Nevada. Now, it's not as though the Obama administration did not use federal forces as law enforcement vehicles when necessary, just like every other administration ever. And for him, again, to use the language of federal officers are using tear gas again, blah, blah, blah. Like, what are you kidding me? I mean, are you kidding me? What is going on here? He knows.
I mean, it's unclear whether he's talking about Lafayette Park or Portland, but
okay, well,
the introduction of batons in that sort of blurs the line to the point
right.
of making right. it indistinct.
Also, you know what? I'm gonna now be provocative and incendiary and say that for somebody to compare what is going on now in the United States with a single cop in Minneapolis doing this horrific thing to George Floyd, to Bull Connor and George Wallace. George Wallace was the governor of the state of Alabama and used state police to block the entrance of people into school buildings to which they were legally given the right to enter. Bull Connor and Lester Maddox and other law enforcement officials who ran law departments of law enforcement who were explicitly racist and explicitly ideological in their application of their force. And to compare that to rogue efforts on the grounds that they represent some mystical form of white supremacy that is putting down, you know, people of color. Again, is this something that a former president of the United States, is this an idea that a former president of the United States should be retailing? If we're going to be walking around talking about how the current president of the United States is wildly irresponsible with his rhetoric and his proposals about what the United States is constituted like, I mean, you know, it's disgusting to me that you know, we sit here and try to make sense out of Trump and criticize Trump when necessary. Where are the people defending the United States and its institutions against Barack Obama's depredations? Where are they? Why didn't this eulogy yesterday trigger some of this reaction that I'm having? Like, don't change Mitch McConnell. When Harry Reid eliminated the filibuster in one area, right, which was for judicial nominees, in 2013, as part of the general doctrine that we can't wait and Republicans shouldn't be allowed to retard Democratic decision-making. Mitch McConnell said, you will regret this. You, because power changes and we're going to get control of the Senate and then we're going to do what you're trying to do to us. And damn if that didn't exactly happen in 2014. It didn't happen when Trump became president and they could force through these 200 judicial nominations. And now they want to do it with the entire Senate. And what if, you know, Tucker Carlson gets elected in 2024 with a Republican Congress and a Republican Senate? And then, you know, the guy who was his writer, he nominates for, you know, a judgeship, and then it's forced through on a 51-49 voice vote.
More. Republicans have been nowhere near as pliant as Democrats when it comes to this issue. Donald Trump has been lobbying for the elimination of the legislative filibuster forever. And Mitch McConnell issued a second warning in June to Democrats, noting, I want you to remember that you might not be in total control in the future, and reminding them how they did nothing to the legislative filibuster with the understanding that they may not be in the majority forever. Despite the president's agitation to that effect, Democrats have demonstrated that they do not have the kind of fortitude that Republicans had in resisting the appeal of the White House when it's under their control.
Abe, you know, one thing occurs to me that we have this interesting total yin-yang, black-white distinction here, or, you know, however you want to slice it, between Trump and Obama, that Trump talks like a fascist, but governs like a kind of somewhat mildly incompetent you know, guy who doesn't know how to exercise power. And Obama speaks in the most honeyed possible way and was a complete determined Caesar of power. Caesar, I mean, not Caesar, I mean S-E-I-Z-E-R, mm-hmm. However you spell C's. But was always like, look, if you have a good idea, I'm for good ideas from all parts of the political spectrum. And we're all one country and all of that. And you know what? People should take a lesson from this, because Obama was a vastly more successful president, I believe, in some understandings. Maybe, we'll see. But I mean, than Trump was, because he got the tone right while he was arrogating power to the federal government and to, you know, centralized authorities and all that in a way that no one ever had before in peacetime. Like, I mean, people had in, you know, even so Trump's manner is to like act like he's a, you know, he's a crazy authoritarian, but he doesn't know how to execute it and doesn't really have the energy. And Obama is, you know, Mr. Nice Guy, who is basically destroying foundations of government as he goes.
Well, I think, you know, I'd take it farther, which is that just as Obama acts or has acted like Mr. Nice Guy because he thinks it is a tactical asset, Trump somehow thinks that his off-the-rail tweets and proclamations also somehow sell him, right? And that this is, taking the yin-yang thing into consideration, this is what actually people want. They want the fierce wild man to make these proclamations, sort of regardless of what actually happens. I mean, there's this response that's bubbled up since yesterday, since Trump's tweet and since Trump pinned his tweet saying that elections should be postponed or delayed. This idea that, don't you get it? Everyone's getting upset. He's just trolling. This is what he does. This is how he makes the liberals crazy. And then they overshoot. And they say, I don't doubt that is a huge part of it. That's terrible. You don't troll with assertions about changing the structure of presidential elections. That in and of itself is a absolutely terrible excuse. Now, given that Trump speaks like a fascist and governs like a sort of indifferent incompetent, and Obama speaks mildly and tries to upend the system, what happens, I think, and this is like across the board, is that we inevitably end up with only the worst of both, right? So now we have Obama out there speaking like the sort of mirror image of Trump and overtly proposing and endorsing things that are in reality dramatic and terrible, and everyone nodding and assenting.
Yeah. So Jim Meggs, on Wednesday, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and remind me who else?
Apple's Tim Cook. And Google's Sundar Pichai.
Right. Appear before a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, which had covered itself in such glory the previous day with Bill Barr, the Attorney General, to get raked over the coals for the fact that the tech industry whatever exists and is making a lot of money and somehow isn't doing the right thing in some fashion. Can you give us a sense of your sense of that hearing and what it portends about the future of tech in this world in which both conservatives and liberals and Democrats and Republicans all seem to be hungering to impose the harsh hand of regulation,
or at least to talk really tough. You know, these hearings are always so painful to watch as everybody just tries to outdo each other in grandstanding. And typically the people, as we saw with the Bill Barr hearing, don't get a lot of chance to actually explain themselves. That sometimes the representatives almost seem insulted that somebody actually wants to answer the question they've just posed. But what was interesting about this one and what made it kind of entertaining was that it was such a bipartisan raking over the coals over different issues mostly, but the sense of antipathy was just, overwhelming. And people are calling it a tech lash. And, you know, the Wall Street Journal said that the hearing was almost universally hostile. Typically, you'd see Republicans step in and at least make some defense of business and free enterprise. And there was a little bit of that. James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, he's the top Republican on the committee. He actually defended the current antitrust laws. He said they don't really need to be changed. But there was just a piling on from both sides. The Democrats talked a lot about competition and how these companies stifle competition. They talked about some of their kind of sketchy records of acquiring companies, seemingly for the purpose of just limiting them or eliminating them as potential competitors. In some cases, they acquire companies and then just shut them down. But the Republicans kept coming back to the free speech issue. And that, too, is about power. You know, when this very small number of institutions, when everything flows through a handful of platforms, you know, you have so much of online commerce going through Amazon, but especially Facebook and Google, when so much of the content that people consume and share moves through those two platforms, the power they have is really kind of terrifying. And so I think the Republicans are right to ask questions. I think their framing of the questions doesn't necessarily help their case. It's often like, you know, are conservatives being censored? Are conservatives getting a fair shot? I think the questions about how those companies manipulate speech run deeper than just, are they intentionally censoring conservatives? I mean, that is a legitimate question, but I think they're doing more in the way that their algorithms work to distort our discourse, some of which isn't even controlled by individual humans. Some of it's just in the way the algorithms sort out certain kinds of shareable content, encourage people to gravitate towards the most extreme content. And now they're trying to use their AI engines to somehow limit what they see as dangerous falsehoods, you know, and you can appreciate them trying to do that. You can see why they're trying to do that. But that, to me, as a civil libertarian, is a real dangerous slope to get on when you start deciding what's accurate speech and what's not accurate speech. And we've seen a lot of examples of that just in the last couple of weeks.
Well, so I think that there are two related questions that are raised by this. The first is whether Congress is outmatched by these guys who, you know, I think if you added up their net worth, come out to about, you know, closing in on $500 trillion or something like that, or $300 billion, something. And, you know, these guys may be members of Congress and they get votes and they have the power to write laws and all this, but they're pipsqueaks next to these, you know, wildly dominant figures, and that basically they're going to be outthought. Whatever efforts they make to rein in the power of these guys will have so much on the line and have so much, have unlimited resources to feint and dodge against them, that what's going to happen is a form of regulatory capture in which there will be changes made that will cosmetically look as though the tech companies are being reined in, but that in fact will exist only to enshrine their power forever and to make it impossible for anybody to come up, lap them, and take their place. Right, that's the regulatory capture theory.
I completely agree with that, and that's why I'm very, very leery of attempts to directly regulate them. Because typically, what you'll see is that those kinds of regulatory regimes will, yes, you have regulatory capture in that the companies being regulated have enormous influence over how those laws are written and then how those regulations are enforced. But you also have these cases where some burdensome regulations are just fine for huge, incredibly wealthy companies. I mean, it's a hundredth of a percentage point off of their revenues to hire the armies of lawyers and whatever they need to cope with it. But it's a great way to keep out new competitors. If you're trying to start up some new social channel and you're six kids in a dorm room at in Southern California, you don't have the resources to jump through all the regulatory hoops. So the very rules that are set up to restrain companies from abusing their power become obstacles to new companies getting started. And so this is one of those cases. I don't have a solution to this. I'm very concerned about the consolidation of power in these companies. I'm also very leery of attempts to craft legislation that's gonna rein that in. But I'm open to hearing the different ideas about applying antitrust law and other mechanisms to consider putting some kind of restraints on here.
Well, the second, I think, related issue is would be the opposite, which is when you have conservatives who don't like the tech companies because they think that they're suppressing their speech, and liberals who don't like them because they've accreted too much power or too large, have too much money or making too much money, and are therefore at any moment could, you know, raise prices that make it impossible for less well-to-do people, you know, to do all that and to get internet bandwidth and access and all of that. And there'll be haves and have nots. That when you have this kind of consensus that we were talking about earlier that eludes the Senate mostly and everybody else, something big is going to happen. Like, this is one thing on which liberals and conservatives seem to agree, that the tech companies are turning into the bad guys and something big is going to happen. My proposition would be, based on things that I've read, that people will essentially declare, the Senate or the Congress or whatever, will essentially declare internet access and the use of the internet a public utility. And they will become versions of Ma Bell or something, like either versions of Ma Bell, which of course is bad because Ma Bell restrained innovation in the tech space for decades. Or they will be nationalized, and or parts of what they do will become part of a grid that will be run by the federal government,
which is a terrible, terrible idea. You know, you saw this in all the garment rending over net neutrality, and the idea that without rules to make sure we have equal access to the internet, somehow these evil corporations are going to come in and clamp down. Of course, It hasn't happened. There are definitely areas where people don't have as many choices in internet access as we'd like. But there's all these new technologies coming down, including, you know, getting the internet from space, which Elon Musk is working on. In 10 years, there's going to be a bunch of new ways for people to get internet access. There's no reason for it to be regulated like a utility. And in fact, if we did do that, we'd probably see progress stop. I mean, look at your power. Look at your outlet in your office. That's a 120-volt, 60-cycle power grid. That standard was set up in the 1920s. It hasn't changed since. And so, you know, once you turn something into a utility, you tend to freeze the technology in place. I honestly, if we'd done this back in the 90s, we'd all still be using dial-up.
Can I tell you a story? Something I found out last week, totally by happenstance, because one of my kids said to me, "How come the numbers on FM or what? How come it's only 87.5 to 107.9 or whatever it is? What does that mean?" I'm like, "I don't know. I mean, it's some megahertz. I don't know. Whatever." So I then look it up, and it turns out that the bandwidth of this particular band was actually from the 60s to the 80s in the 1930s, and that RCA, run by David Sarnoff, had a preference in its own equipment or some setting or something. He wanted, and they wanted, this band to be in the higher megahertz number from the high 80s into the hundreds, and somehow got the FCC to declare that this area below it would no longer be for, you know, broadcast, whatever, and was shifted basically to help this one company that was selling radios. So that's a version of this.
Right. I mean, so the history of how bandwidth was divided up in the early to mid 20th century is actually pretty fascinating, in that these huge chunks of bandwidth were delivered to the three networks for their TV stations in the major cities. Those are incredibly valuable resources that were essentially given away. It was kind of like a land grant approach to the airwaves. And it did lead to the development of broadcasting, but it became a an example of a case where, you know, you don't have perfect foresight. Fortunately, since everything's gone digital, they've been able to go back in and carve up those huge swaths of bandwidth that used to be required for over-the-air television and other things, and cram a lot more data in there. So they're managing that better today. But that FM dial is a great example of how an old technology can live on in our symbolism, or even in the words we use. So who knows? Yeah. You know, there may be examples of that in our digital era too. But but to the question of, can Congress come up with a smart way to regulate this? I think the utility approach would probably be about one of the worst options. I think that an antitrust approach that limits their acquisition of new companies and targets some of their more abusive business practices might be, and again, I would need to be convinced of this, but that might be the approach that does the least damage and has the least, you know, opportunity to set up a regulatory capture kind of situation.
Well, let me propose one other thing, because Christine Rosen talked about this in a piece she wrote for us on Facebook and basically why it needed to be broken up. And that is that this much controversial, very complicated, it's not this simple, but the drafting of the update of the Federal Communications Act that led to this Section 230 that mm-hmm. essentially declared that if you were an internet mail provider, largely, or someone who transmitted information from one person to another, that you could not be held liable for what was said in that communication, and that this was then deemed to cover social media and Facebook and Twitter and all that, that they were transmission points. They were not creators of content. They could not be considered liable as companies for the discussions and things that were going on, that they were simply a vehicle for the transmission of. But you know what? Facebook, you know, now has 2 billion users worldwide, and it's one of the largest companies in the world. And what if it were? What if they just changed the rules? What if they rewrote Section 230 and Facebook did become liable for slanders and stuff like that? Not this question of whether or not it should be checking facts, but simply that it was no longer a bystander to what was going on its platform. You think it wouldn't come up with a way to make sure that there weren't libels and slanders on its site? Of course it would. If they had to hire 25,000 people or 30,000 lawyers to do this, it would still be less. That would just be the cost of doing business, like opening a new factory for GM when GM starts Saturn. You know, it has to hire 30,000 people.
Right. So, but here's the problem I'm talking about as in terms of barriers to entry for other players. Section 230 was part of the Communications Decency Act of 1996. So basically it means that you can't treat somebody who transmits third-party content as a publisher and sue them for what's in that content, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah. So maybe Facebook could hire thousands of readers to double check and screen stuff for libel and other problems. But could commentary do that for the people who comment on the website?
But we eliminated comments.
Oh, right. You did. Yeah.
And we literally eliminated comments for this very reason, that we did not want to feel responsible for things on our website that we did not edit or control.
Right.
And that was a editorial corporate decision that we made.
Yeah. Well, that's a choice people can make, but many businesses that, you know, rely on online reviews, commentary, you know, individual bloggers, If you make everyone liable, I think there's really good arguments to keep Section 230 more or less intact, and they come down to enabling free speech. And so I think that the penalty, what would happen if you got rid of it, might not slow down the giants very much, but it would paralyze everybody else that is part of this vibrant exchange of ideas. And even a giant site like Twitter, if they were all of a sudden responsible for every idiotic thing somebody says, I don't think any of us would be able to express ourselves very openly. Because, like, wait, you just criticized somebody. We can't put up that tweet for 3 days until somebody gets a chance to check and make sure what you just said about whoever isn't libelous. So be careful what you wish for on this. You know,
I'm not wishing. By the way, my presumption is that something's going to happen and it will be the worst possible thing. In some ways, you could say that Section 230, it's a very complicated issue, but it was a fantastic thing for a while, and now it's increasingly less fantastic. Precisely because of Twitter. Like, Twitter has had a horribly destructive effect on the national political conversation. And yet, you know, would I have wished the internet not to develop as it did in the mid-90s onward without the heavy hand of government controlling every move? Yes. But then things happen.
And this is what I think has really taken a lot of the digital utopians, and I was certainly one of the early aughts. We all thought that, you know, there would be 1,000 flowers blooming and everyone would have their own blogs and there would be this wonderful diversity of ideas. And somehow it all got sucked into this maw of the tech giants. And that I would include individual publications. I think between them, Google and Facebook have something like 55% of all digital revenue on the internet. Well, a lot of that revenue is coming from people who are advertising against content that's created by people like Commentary or you know, or Entertainment Weekly magazine or all kinds of content creators, and the New York Times or the Washington Post, that are spending a lot of money to create content, but most of the revenue is going to Google or Facebook. Because when people link to that content, they've found this brilliant way to basically piggyback on all the work everybody else does, but suck all the money out of the exchange.
Let's move on. Let me want to talk to conclude by talking to you about the piece that you have in our July-August issue that is on our website at commentarymagazine.com called Our Overconnected World. Because as a civil libertarian, as you say, there is an interesting connection between your belief in letting 1,000 flowers bloom and the decentralization of all discourse and a problem that you have discerned in the nature of how we are handling tech and some of these things in that it is becoming more centralized in some ways and that is or sort of the way we are living is becoming more centralized in a way that is potentially of actual danger to us and the good working order of how we live. Can you
flesh
it out?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time studying disasters and how disasters happen. And there's this concept in that field called a tightly coupled system. That would be something where many different parts of a mechanical or a digital system are interlinked in such a way that a problem in one area can rapidly drag down other parts of the system. And the classic example would be the way that all the different power utilities are connected so they can shift power around at really on a split second basis if demand goes up or goes down here or there. And it's a great system that allows them to keep the lights on in all kinds of conditions. But if something goes really wrong in one part of one grid and they can't cope with it, that problem then can propagate. And we saw that in the, I believe it was a 2003 blackout, the Northeast blackout, about this time of year, and that dragged down the whole Northeast and Eastern Canada in one giant blackout. You also see it in cases where you have a problem in certain plane crashes. You have a problem in one part of the airplane, but ultimately it involves other systems on the airplane that in a way that could ultimately be fatal. So what are we seeing in our tech world today? Well, what we've done is we've tightly coupled things that used to be really, really separate. You know, we used to all get little newspapers delivered to our front doorstep, you know, in those ancient times, and people would subscribe to different magazines. Conversations that happened in person or over the phone. There were thousands of independent radio stations around the country. As communication has gotten more and more funneled through, again, these tech giants, what does that mean? It means that the whole system runs much more quickly and smoothly, but also bad ideas can spread really quickly. Misconceptions can spread really quickly. And I believe the system has gotten more of a hair trigger that can be dangerous. And I do think it has enabled, you were talking about Twitter, it's enabled extremism. The writer Zeynep Tufekci, who sometimes writes for the New York Times and is a professor of some kind of digital sociology, I think. Anyway, brilliant commentator on this particular issue. And she talks about the way that the algorithms that make these big tech giants work often will exacerbate the most or exaggerate the most extreme versions of any particular comment. So something that might have been really on the fringe and stayed on the fringe in the past now gets dragged into the center.
And it strikes me that with tightly coupled systems, you're also open to a far greater danger to those who would seek to attack, right? And to exploit the tightly coupled system in a malicious attack, because whereas before they might be able to target one small piece, now if they have the sufficient know-how and they find the right single switch to flick, they can do incredible damage against you, right, or against us, right? They can shut down a whole massive network for the purpose of destabilizing us.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the nightmare scenarios that war planners and others look at is some kind of information warfare that would knock out these highly centralized systems. There was a very ominous thing that happened a couple of weeks ago. Twitter got hacked. I don't know if you guys remember this. And it looked like some kind of a Bitcoin scam. I don't think it necessarily was. I think that was some deeper experiment going on there. But it was very, very ominous. They were able to get right into the heart of the network and take over the accounts of some of the most famous people on Twitter. And how could they do that? Because it's centralized. You know, you get into the network and you can control the network. In contrast, again, let's say you were a dictator, you wanted to have a coup and take over all the radio stations in the country. In the old days, you'd have to send your guys with guns to every radio station.
Right.
You know? Today, it would be a lot easier if you could take over, you know, Google and Facebook and Twitter. You could control what everybody sees. You know, again, it's a nightmare scenario, but this tight coupling, this more tightly coupled communication system we have, it does a lot of wonderful things really well and really efficiently, but it also has this potential for kind of a system-wide failure or vulnerability.
It's interesting because, you know, one of the things that we were promised by the digital age was a kind of decentralization in that the internet was itself, there was no internet. There was no central thing called the internet. It was this infinite network of computers all storing information for each other in different ways. And then over time, like everything else, things started to centralize so that you have these web services like Amazon. People don't really know this, but half of Amazon's business is this thing called Amazon Web Services, which is basically the world's largest internet host. And this is one of the things that, you know, Trump, who doesn't like Bezos because he owns the Washington Post or whatever, is like freaked out by Amazon Web Services. But he's right in the sense that if you have an enormous centralization of the storage of information and on the World Wide Web in the hands of one company, and that company can somehow be subjected to an electromagnetic pulse attack, or I know it's hard to, I mean, I don't even know what I'm talking about how technically it would happen. But this was all supposed to be vitiated. The entire development of the internet was an effort to create a system that would not be destroyable in a nuclear attack. That's what
right.
DARPA, when DARPA came up with the idea for the internet, it was the radical decentralization of computerization so that things could survive if, you know, things were melted down by a nuclear strike. And now they're all aggregating again into centralized locations.
Boy, this got dark.
Well, can I?
Yeah, I know. Hey, this is our podcast. We are dark.
Well, hey, since we're on like disaster movie scenarios, can I give you my fantasy disaster movie scenario regarding this stuff?
Well, of course.
Okay. So there's consolidation, tech consolidation, 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 right? And then some genius digital terrorist comes up with the idea whereby he attacks our consolidated system. We all wake up one day and every email is just available. Everyone can read everyone else's email. Every secret, every scheme, every hidden, the whole place where we invest our secret and private lives is exposed to everyone. All bonds of trust break down immediately. People are jumping out of windows. Governments, corporations break down. Marriages fall apart. Everyone knows everything about everyone else.
I mean, if you're conspiring via email, a discoverable medium, you're a terrible conspiracy theorist in the first place.
But it's not a conspiracy. It's like, what if, you know, like, yeah, you find out that somebody insulted you. You know, you find out that someone you thought was your friend said something nasty about you to another person. That's all it takes to break down all social trust. Right. Well, it's the Gillen Maxwell story right now.
There you go.
Well, this happened actually. I mean, this happened on a small scale with the Sony Pictures hack in 2014. And, you know, I used to cover the movie business. I know some of the people who were involved in this. And you know how people in the entertainment industry talk. I mean, they pride themselves on being coarse and unguarded. And so the stuff that came out in these emails was just a lot of nasty criticisms, a lot of revealing of what people were really negotiating behind the scenes. It practically brought down the studio. It was absolutely devastating. And it was exactly that, Abe. It was, oh my God, honesty.
Right.
You know, we can't survive that.
The head of the studio was Amy Pascal had to resign for insulting Angelina Jolie, I believe.
Yeah.
Primarily.
This would be a great book for somebody because it'd be a great case study in what happens when you know this kind of transparency is opposed. And again, if all of those communications had gone by phone instead of by email, if they weren't all those emails weren't stored on one server, this wouldn't have been possible. You know, it's that consolidation. But to your point, John, about the internet being more consolidated, you can rest a little bit easier about that, even though, you know, Amazon may own a lot of servers. A, they're not all in the same place. They're distributed around the world. And B, the internet is still set up as a kind of a self-organized network where signals, where messages travel, and they find the best available route to the web address that you're looking for. And so they reroute around damage. They reroute around problems. And that it still works that way. So where the consolidation has happened hasn't been at that base level of the internet so much as in the tools we use to organize the way that we get around. So if everybody uses Google, then that becomes a kind of centralization. I've been using DuckDuckGo search engine, which results are nowhere near as good as Google's, but just it's my little protest, you know, of monopoly power. I still use Gmail and all the rest, but you know, there are alternatives, and none of these companies own the internet. You know, what they own is a lot of internet users and the way that people get on to, you know, to do the work that they want to do. But that's not permanent unless we regulate it in a way that makes it permanent. You know, it's always like Facebook has faded a lot among younger people. I think that, you know, we could see big changes there. I think we could see changes in the way people do search if they get nervous enough about this. So I think if we don't let these companies influence government enough to enhance their power, then as worrisome as it is right now, I think it's not a problem that necessarily continues getting worse. It could change and get better at some point in the future.
hey, we're going to end on an optimistic note. What the hell is going on? This is just glaringly inappropriate for our crushing morosity. But what can I do? Jim Meggs is a more cheerful person.
Yeah, the eternal optimist. Or, you know, I mean, I study disasters, but I'm also sort of temperamentally on the optimistic side. I've sometimes learned to temper that a little bit during this pandemic time, I got to say.
Fair enough. So thank you so much for being with us. We will have you on again. Christine Rosen will be back on Monday for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.